Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm really happy to have in studio with me Mark Stig Donnie here. And we're going to talk about he's a backline guitar tech, and he works on all the guitars. He's worked for Neil Giraldo and John Fogerty of Credence Clearwater. And we're going to talk about more of the live setup and some of the problems and challenges he has with different guitars and doing live sound, keeping everybody running and those shows running every day or every night. So welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you, Stig.
Thank you, Jeff. Wonderful to be here.
So tell me a little bit. I know you're a guitar player. Give us a little bit of your background in guitar playing, and how did you get into the tech business?
Well, I think I was about 11 or 12 and found an acoustic guitar stuffed in the attic at my parents' house. I think my dad had got it from a salesman to give us a gift for Christmas, but we blew his cover. We discovered it a few months early, and I took it out of the case and was hooked.
Now, you gigged for a while, and then what made you take the transition into repair and tech and maintaining the guitars?
I did. I gigged. I've been gigging actually through my transition into teching, but it always bothered me that something just wasn't quite right or had to make it better.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Being a mechanically inclined kid and taking trucks and toys apart and fixing them and all that stuff.
So you're one of those guys that would just take things apart and see how they worked.
And experimenting with guitars and trying to make them do this and that, but I was careful enough to not break them further. And so at about 20, I had been working as a chef in a ski area near my place, had a February blowout or rain out, and I went down to my local music store and talked the guitar tech into making me his apprentice.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, he was really, really qualified guy, Richard French, and he had trained with a guy who had been repairing my guitars for years and had since left that store. But this guy was a MIT graduate student. His upcoming project was making a magnetic drive to launch aircraft off of aircraft carriers. Up into that point it was steam driven, and an aircraft carrier had to carry a lot of water to do that. So he had a brain that was way beyond guitars, but I got a lot of background on metals and the way things react.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different pieces of a guitar react with each other and all that from this guy. So it was a pretty thorough apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't just, you put strings on that way.
Now, he worked at a guitar shop, or was he?
Yes, he was. He had been working. That was, you know, his make some money job while he was at MIT.
Mm.
And I was lucky enough to apprentice with him. He had picked up all kinds of guitar and wood practice and theory from the former guitar tech that was there. And so I was a beneficiary.
Very, 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 very cool. Yeah. So, well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've done. Now, you had mentioned that you had tech for Neil Giraldo. Can you describe, let's kind of break it down, take a look at his setup, and then the challenges and the problems, or, you know, to maintain that, to make sure that he was on stage fine.
Well, Neil is a great gig. Neil is a great gig.
Mm-hmm. He's a great guitar player.
He's an MF guitar player, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
He's badass. Running a lot of Marshalls, Bradshaw switching system, different guitar studio effects, reverbs, and whatnot. And, Marshalls running.
Are they stock Marshalls or are they modded?
6550 tubes, and then running into 412s with Celestion greenbacks. Mm-hmm. Pretty standard, you know, great sounding rig.
But the amps are stock.
Amps are stock, except for the you don't often find 6550s in a Marshall. It's more of an EL34 thing. But he had a modified. So he was running that, and for the year that I was with him, a year and 4 months, he was playing and was very happy with a Guild Starfire that had we put on a, or he had previously put on a Gibson Nashville Tune-O-Matic bridge that was wasn't the best ultimate design.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a vast improvement on the rosewood footed bridge that would just sit on that guitar in its original design.
Yeah,
because those bridges move around and it's just not adequate for a.
Well, I'm surprised, and tell me how he does it, because the Starfire, it's not like a ES335 or something where it has the slab down the center, and it's a hollow body. It's a true hollow body. How did he? It must have. Feedbacked a lot. How did he control that?
Well, he's really good with his volume control.
Okay.
Really good. And it just happened to work out that he could had the stage volume thing down to make it all work for him.
You know?
The guitar with a Gibson Tune-O-Matic studs put into the top is considerably less feedback than the stock model. But this particular one, they had stuffed it with a whole lot of filler.
Oh, okay. So they filled it. Now, this is the guitar you have in the studio?
This guitar that I have in the studio, I bought after I finished working with Pat and Neil. And it's one of the new issue Starfires from Guild. And I had been thinking about it for a while on how to make the guitar that Neil had a little better, a little more rock friendly, because it sings the guitar being a hollow body and a thin line hollow body sings really well. It's got a lot of good rich low end.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about it for a while, and maybe 6-7 months after I had stopped working with Neil, I bought one of these new, and. Looked at it inside and then made some adjustments on the bracing. And I was, I happened to be looking at Mastery Bridges, which is actually designed by a guy in Minnesota for jazz masters. Sits in these little cups that go into the body of the solid body of a jazz master. So I figured out a way to slightly modify Guild's tone bar bracing at the right spots, and I drilled out, and you know, it was hair raising, drilling my new guitar out, but it does it great.
Before you get into what you did, because I want you to go in more detail about the bracing, real quick, how do you like the new Guilds compared to the old Guilds?
They're doing a good job. Okay. And we'll back up a little bit. The people that are at Fender, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he was in charge of all their reissue guitars when Fender owned both on Fender stuff and when Fender owned Guild. He made sure that the recreations that they were doing, the reissued models, followed truthfully what those original guitars did. So they had done a lot of this research to make sure these pickups sound that way, that the pots had the right value, that all the design in the guitar originally, all the tone bar bracing, the thicknesses of the tops and sides and all that, they were very meticulous about doing these reissue models. And now Guild is owned by Cordoba, Santa Monica based classical guitar builder, but they have since built a brand new factory for themselves up in Oxnard, and they're doing a great job. This particular one and most of their electrics are designed here, meticulously recreated, and they're being built at some really good factories in Vietnam and China.
Oh, okay. So they're not made here, but the feel of the neck and stuff is like the old ones?
Everything is really close. I mean, Fender gave us one while I was out with Neil, and it was so close. We were stunned and pleased.
Because this one that you brought in is really nice.
Yeah, I'm very happy with it. I had one of these when I was a kid. And to be able to get another one, brand new, and do a little bit of work and make it even better, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you modified the Guild bracing and the problems that you encountered. Because again, there is no block of wood under it, so it's nothing to mount it on.
Right.
So how were you able to stabilize the mastery bridge on there? And get it to be kind of pretty rock solid.
Yeah. Well, without revealing my patent applied for modifications, I was very meticulous. I thought about it a lot. I'm like, well, okay, here's the original bridge, and it's a kind of like a Nashville tunematic bridge that sits on a couple of studs that sit in a footing, a rosewood fitting, and that just sits on top of the guitar. And for what it is, the original design of a Starfire, you know, it's not a rock and roll beast. You're not going to get away with really cranking this thing up. And if you're really digging in, these bridges move because they're not anchored to anything. So Neil had a technician, Eric, I believe, up at Tour Supply, had modified it for Peter Baines, Neil's tech. And they put in a Nashville tunematic bridge with the studs right into the top of the guitar. And it held somewhat. There were a couple of times over the year I worked with them that I had to re-glue it. Just to stabilize it because it would rock back and forth. And
right, he had a Bigsby on it, so he was moving it.
Yeah. So I thought about how to. I examined the bracing inside and said, "Well, you know, the secret to this guitar sounding the way it does, the sound that we all love, is this what Guild has is called a tone bar bracing, and basically it's a couple of pieces of wood that go from the neck pocket" down to the heel. So I've thought about it for a bit, and I said, well, there's got to be a way to make this, alter this somewhat without putting in like a block that would make it a 335. Mm-hmm. And you lose a lot of the character of the guitar because you're making it a, kind of making that focal point into a solid body, you know, that point under the ridge.
Right, right.
So I slightly modified the area of the tone bar bracing that the bridge had to be at. And which gave me a lot of stiffness right under that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to put in these mastery cups, studs, or stud receptacles. I can't remember what they call them. Damn. Should have done a little bit of homework. Or refreshing. But anyway, it's a mastery bridge that I used that's rock solid. It's all milled stainless steel. The gentleman in Minnesota, I believe, that designed this thing for Jazz Masters is a monstrously great designer. He's eliminated all those problems that you had with the Jazz Master bridge.
Right. To explain a little bit, the Jazz Master bridge was basically it would just sit in these two receptacles, and would literally just on the screw tip would just balance on there. But when you would use the vibrato, it kind of rock back and forth because it wasn't solidly in there.
Right.
And so you get this rocking, mm-hmm. and it could cause it to go out of tune. And I have the same problem with the Jaguar.
Right.
Both of them had that.
Oops. Yeah, their tolerances were, you know, and the thought being it was, you know, you have a nice vibrato kind of effect, and it's just rocking back and forth. It's going to rock back into the in-tone position.
Right.
Well, if you get a little more aggressive with that kind of a thing, it's never going to rock back to that center position.
Yeah.
So the people at Mastery, their tolerances between the studs that the bridge sit on and the cup that it sits in, which is the receptacle in the guitar, is really super tight. And they've also are using stainless steel throughout the whole bridge. No more rust problems, really tight tolerances. So the sustain and the clarity that I've gained out of this guitar, doing it that way. And if you use it on a Jazzmaster, of course, because that's what it's designed for, is through the roof. It's probably the biggest improvement in the Fender Jazzmaster of the last 30 years.
So you have to put in new studs where it sits, and you replace the old ones.
Yeah, it's made. They're made the studs that the bridge sit on will fit into the stock fenders. They've made them big enough to fit in a stock fender receiver, but they make those receivers out of stainless steel. That you can replace them with. So.
Now, have you noticed any difference with the stainless steel in the tone?
Well, it's really the clarity and sustain is through the roof. Now, I have an A-bead, the existing Jazzmaster receiver with the new one, but
because we noticed with, for example, with Strats. One of the things I noticed with Floyd Rhodes, which when the Floyd is a stainless steel, is it changed the tone as opposed to the metal that they used on the original Strat, which was cheap metal.
Stamped steel, right.
But it had a tone to it.
It does. It does. It has a very distinct tone. And, you know, that's the compromise. It's sometimes, you know, if you're Eddie and you need a Floyd, and nothing else is going to work except a locking bridge and a locking nut, then that's where you're at.
Yeah, no, but I mean, there were other bridges like Godo. I have a locking Godo that's made out of a different metal. It's more like, it sounds more like the old Strat metal.
I hear you.
Wondering if Mastery makes, if you can get the bridge pieces, that you can get of a different composite or different alloy, so it sounds more like the vintage
Jazzmaster. Well,
or actually, you know, like a vintage Strat, or you know, that tone. It's
yeah,
it's a definite sound.
It seems to me this is such a vast improvement. I mean, the bridge of the old Jazzmaster, God bless Leo Fender. Mm-hmm. They made what they had to make, and it worked, and they're great. But this is an incredible sonic improvement. I'm really digging these guys.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at their site. It's www.masterybridge.com, and they have, besides the offset bridge, which is for the Jazzmaster and Jaguar, they have a Tele, and they have a Rickenbacker bridge, which is interesting
because
I have an old Rickenbacker and it rattles.
Yeah.
So it's very cool.
Yeah,
these guys
are good. You know, Leo Fender, they used like a, what was it, threaded rod for the saddle pieces. And, you know, it was their new guitar, and they were innovating stuff. But when you got anywhere near digging in and aggressive on that bridge, and the strings would just pop right out.
Yeah,
you
know, I've had that happen. All of a sudden, my string spacing. I mean, the thread was cool because you could adjust the string spacing, but it popped a lot.
Yeah. Well, so. You know, our good friends at Mastery have figured all this stuff out, and they really overachieved and over-engineered, and we have a wonderful, amazing product here. So
now the way the guitar, the Guild, is set up, and I presume it's, you know, the double cutaway Starfires. I presume they're like this, the same construction. They don't have a block of wood down them, do they?
Well, I believe now the Starfire 5, which does not have a Bigsby, it's more of a 335, and I think they're doing that with solid block.
But this guitar, the pickups, are they actually on the? Are they on the? I don't know how to describe this, but are they connected or mounted more on those two blocks of wood, or are they on the soundboard?
Well, if you can envision the Guild tone bar bracing is say between 3/4 and 1 inch square pieces of wood. And those run the length of the guitar from the neck pocket down to the heel, to where your strap button is. So and that's all the bracing for the top. In fact, that's all the bracing. There's no bracing on the back. And it's a laminated top. So there's some strength to that, but where you need the strength for the bridge placement, that's where it is. It just runs down the center of the top of the guitar. The pickups mount to each side, to each block there. So
it's not really grab. Is the pickup getting any of the vibration of the top, or is it more just?
Well,
solid?
It does. See, that's the beauty of this design of these tone bar bracings is that there's such little bracing on the top.
Mm-hmm.
That you're getting a lot of the vibration of the top to still be able to activate, and it comes through the sound of the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So the more bracing you put on, you know, like an acoustic, you need a lot of bracing underneath. And there are different ways to do it. Sometimes they do herringbone bracing where they shave some of the bracing away, and that does different things to the sound. You know, it allows the top to vibrate more.
Now, also, too, you have on here, you put a new Bigsby, a B7.
I did.
And it has the little bar. This Bigsby, there's two types of Bigsbys, for those that don't know. There's one that just has the vibrato with no bar, so like a lot of the jazz guitars, so it just lays on the top so you don't have any holes. But this one has a bar to lower the strings so that the angle against the bridge, it gives it a little bit more sustain. And that bar, though, you have to put a screw into the top. Now, is that screw, is that going into that frame, that brace that you're talking about?
My extended modifications allow for the two mounting screws that are on a Bigsby B7. To screw into the
it's stabilized by that extended.
Right, and all this little extra bracing, and inserts for the Mastery bridge, it's all adding a little bit more mass to the guitar. But without getting into a big block situation or a big anchor underneath the top of the guitar, we still can maintain the that wonderful sound that is a Guild Starfire.
Yeah. Okay. But that, yeah, so it's interesting. So basically, there's nothing really hindering the top. The top is vibrating pretty free.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the.
And which I would presume the guitar was, if I'm correct, the original, the design of that guitar was for like a jazz type of player.
I could assume that.
Yeah. It's a pretty, now with the pickups and stuff, I presume it's a pretty mellow sounding guitar.
Well, there's a good amount of brightness and grind to this thing when you really crank it, but they're not quite a full size humbucker in a Guild Starfire. They're kind of halfway between a what do you call those?
Filtertron?
No, there's a full size humbucker and there's a mini humbucker mm-hmm. that Gibson did. These are like halfway between both of those. I find that the mini humbuckers on Gibsons are really, really bright. It was a period where Townsend was using them, probably because his hearing was starting to go. But, you know, and they got a thing. But you can make adjustments on your amp and all that. But these are not quite a full-size humbucker, but they've got a great sound.
So they're not. They don't have as much output as a humbucker, right?
No.
But they should then have more tone.
But they do have. They have a great tone and a lot of definition.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, I like that bridge is stable. I took some pictures and I'll post them up so you can see what he did with the bridge. But when he uses the tremolo on there, that thing is rock solid. It's set in there. It's not moving at all. And it's rock and rollable.
Yeah. That was I just kept thinking the whole time of when I was doing it, how is this guitar going to be better from Niels Giraldo?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've got it, by golly.
Now, yeah. Any other difference between this guitar and what Neil's using?
Well, at the time also, when Neil was using one of these, his main guitar, which he refers to as Pain, because it's pretty difficult to play it, it didn't play like butter.
Mm-hmm.
But he liked that. He liked wrestling it. They had cut out the pickup cavities, pickup holes, to accept full-size humbuckers.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a special winding of a full-size humbucker that Seymour Duncan makes for him. And those were in one of his guitars. But when we got the prototype for these guitars from Guild, we plugged it into his rig, and man, it was really close.
Mm-hmm.
I then went up to MJ at Seymour Duncan and asked her to wind me this size of not quite a full-size humbucker the way that she winds pickups for Neil. So those are coming. That'll be probably on prototype 2.
And his guitar, he has the B7 on there too, or has he had the Guild?
Yes.
Okay. Because it originally had a Guild Bigsby, which without the bar to bring the strings down.
Yeah, we needed the bar to keep the strings in place and mm-hmm. give that extra tension.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a beautiful guitar. And the what does he use anything else, or is that basically what he uses?
Well, you know, he had a few tellies out, but for the year and plus I worked for him, he played that Starfire every night after night,
mm-hmm.
and it, just a great, great tone. I saw a couple of videos of him last summer, and he was playing two different Telecasters. So right now I don't know where he's at.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to see him at the Greek this weekend, and I'll find out.
You have to let us know.
I will.
That's cool. Now, besides the problem with the bridge where it was loosening up and you had to fix that, anything else, any other difficulties or anything that you had to keep an eye on the guitars to run them every night?
Well, you know, you got to make sure this hardware stays bolted down and tight and all that. Mm-hmm. We do. He had Grover locking machines. I've got.
Schallers?
No. Spurzels.
Spurzels.
Spurzels and the Grovers are both made in Cleveland.
Okay.
So I put the Spurzels on because I had some.
Yeah.
They work. They work fine. They're a lighter weight machine than the locking Grovers. You know, there's advantages and disadvantages. I think maybe with the Grovers, maybe the headstock feels a little heavier, but you pick up some attributes with having a little more mass. You know?
Yeah.
I'd like to AB them. I'd like to get another one of these and AB them. You know.
So, yeah. To see what
it could be. Probably a little bit of sustain difference and all that, but. Mm-hmm. But mostly, you know, in this kind of guitar, you got to make sure that the nut is cut properly. I reached a point after maybe 3 weeks working with Neil that the nut was like just perfect, and every string change I'd put a little bit of lubricating grease in there, guitar roadie stuff or something. I don't know what it's called. Mm-hmm. And boy, I had many, many nights where I didn't have to retune him until here comes the encore.
Now, he's not that. Is he brutal on his guitars, or he's pretty?
Of bending, you know, not dive bombing Steve Vai kind of stuff, which you need a Floyd for. Mm. But yeah, we were both pleasantly surprised that we were able to reach that point where he went good most of the night without retuning.
Right, so. But he doesn't thrash his guitars like some guys.
They, no.
Yeah.
No.
So that makes it a little bit easier.
Sure does.
Now, let's talk a little bit about you were working with John Fogerty. And the interesting, we were talking a little bit before the show about him, which I think is great, is he's just like, you know, like us, I guess, in the sense that he's always experimenting and learning more, and he's
always
gone through a bunch of different guitars. So let's talk a little bit about that and his system.
Well, you know, Mr. Fogerty is a force of nature. From what I understand, he's still, you know, practicing 6-7 hours a day. Every night, I was with him for 6 years. It was a great 6 years. And every night he would come out and just bring it, just totally singing all the same, all that stuff in the right key, the original keys from Creedence and all his recordings, and just blazing on guitar.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff he did on Creedence was I mean, now he can hold his own among anybody. I mean,
he nails
taps
it,
he does all of it.
He does, and it's all and always a little trick or a little something new, you know. But the right tone for the right song, he's really
right.
It's great.
So, what amps does he use?
At the time, he was using Cornford for the Dirty Sounds. It was a great big giant amp with four channels he was using for the Clean.
He didn't use custom.
No, but they were all in the storeroom, man. I saw them.
Yeah, I mean, the Creedence sound
the case,
was that Ricky
in the
custom.
Cases with, you know, hand-inked Creedence Clearwater Revival stuff on it. Gave me the willies, man. I was like, wow. I was 9 when that happened, you know.
No, a friend of mine had a custom with the tuck and roll, and I had my Rickenbacker, and it just was the sound. It was,
yeah. In fact, we're, you know, him and I'm sure a lot of other people are still trying to recreate that variable voltage tremolo that the custom amps were famous for.
Those are cool,
you know,
little amps.
Yeah.
Now the when he plays, when he does any of the Creedence songs, does he still use his Rickenbacker?
He does. He uses the Rick. He uses some of those original Les Pauls.
Now on his Rick, did you use the Mastery bridge on there?
No. This was before Mastery was. I think this is while Mastery was formulating his takeover of the world. I was glad to not have to restring the Rick 12 too many times.
Yeah, that's
because those headstocks are crazy. But yeah, he's got, you know, John goes out with in each rig maybe 18, 19 different guitars, and most songs is a guitar change.
Oh wow!
You know, I got hired by him in the fall of 2005, and went to Australia for a month tour for November. I'd never seen any of the gear.
So he has identical setups for different countries?
Well, this particular tour was my first contact with him, and they only had one rig, so all of the gear had gone. And he sent me down to visit his old friend and tech Andy Brower, and we put together some satellite rigs with some different guitars for two gigs that we were going to play before going to Australia. One was a Tonight Show, one was a private gig out in India or something like that. And we played the gigs with a little pedal board and tremolo sound and this and that. So I got to Australia, and there's, you know, a gigantic rig with four different amps and a harp amp that went under the stage and 18, 20 guitars, you know. It was an adventure, man. I was, plugged it all in and got it all going and this and that. We rehearsed for a few days. We did two shows, and I probably hit 85% of the show. And then here comes the Sydney Opera House. And our other tech, Tom Spaulding, the great Tom Spaulding, who is now the D'Addario rep down in Nashville, he had worked for John before. So John wanted the Sydney Opera House to go perfect. And he said, well, Stig, you know, there's really no time to completely train you. You've done a good job, but I'm just going to switch you out with Tom. It'll make me feel a little better. I said, hey, I'm here at your leisure, John. Whatever you want done. So Tom filled out the rest of that month as John's tech. And we came back to the States, and I felt very lucky that I still had a gig.
Well, when Tom was doing it, what did you do?
I moved over to the other side of the stage and worked for the great guitar players, Bob Britt and Billy Burnett. Bob's probably the third or fourth top Nashville session player. Just a great blazing guitar player. And Billy Burnett, you probably know, has written a lot of hit songs, and his dad and his uncle invented rockabilly.
Yes.
And so, you know, and over the next couple of years, watching those guys play from that side of the stage, I probably learned more about playing guitar than I had known in the last 10 years, you know.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. What did Bob and Billy use?
Bob and Billy used, they had probably 8 or 9 guitars between them, some acoustics, Gretsches. Bob's main axe was a Strat at that time. Billy was playing a Gretsch Chet Atkins and Les Paul. We were going into Marshall 800s, 4x12s. They each had a pedal board.
Marshall 800s. And then what was John using?
John was using a couple of, he had a Cornford at that time. Cornford for the dirty sound, and I can't remember. I wish
that was that big amp, the four channel amp.
Yeah, and then his friend, our friend Curtis Lauer would call in and remind me of the name of that amp.
What was the what guitars that was he using? You had the Rickenbacker,
Ricks, Les Pauls, PRS was making him some rather nice Les Paul type, same kind of style guitars at the time. And he was really digging and getting into and trying to find the right tellies.
Okay. And then all of them, did they use acoustic? What did they use acoustically?
Acoustics, we had a really good deal and lots of support from our friends in Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Probably had 8 or 9 Taylors out on the road. And they would keep them in, they'd send us new preamps when we needed them, and they send us new models when we so desired or when they had them coming out.
Now, did they have the Taylors have separate pedal boards? Was there anything particular about those?
No, just with the direct, whatever direct box of the day we were using.
And then the house process.
To the house, yeah.
Yeah. Anything unusual on their pedal boards? Anything, John or?
Well, John had a big Bradshaw rig going with a lot of ever changing different effect pedals. I'll try to get Curtis in here next time, his tech who ended up working with him very successfully for years.
Because a lot of his sound, especially from the Creedence, what we know him from, and even his solo stuff, was pretty straight. I'm trying to think of what he would have used, because he really didn't use a lot in his records.
No, and really a lot of his thinking and execution, whatever different guitars, amps, etc., was all to perfect what he had so successfully put on records so far.
Yeah, he was duplicating what he did on the albums.
So after we were in Australia for that month, a couple of months go by, and this is now February, and John sent out an email to me and said, "Stig, let's you take inventory of everything we have, and we're going to build a second rig so we can stagger them for touring." So I did that and built that whole rig for the entire band. Lots of guitars, speaker cabinets, amps, everything, cables. Just think about it. We need two more of all of it,
Yeah.
And I did all of that over in my shop in North Hollywood, little one room shack on Lancashire Boulevard, mm-hmm. in the rock and roll triangle.
Now, did you have Bradshaw do another board?
Bradshaw built another duplicate for him. And, so I was on the phone with manufacturers getting double this, and send me 4 of those, and I need more guitars for this rig. Gibson was very cooperative. Fender sent us stuff. All the pedal manufacturers, whatever I had and whatever we needed, we built more of them, Tour Supply helped us out with a lot of that mm-hmm. stuff. In fact, from what I remember, Larry at Tour Supply ended up buying a new Corvette that year. God bless
well,
him.
Yeah.
But yeah, I spent a lot of dough, and I became, it made me a really, really good tech. I really am so grateful to John and the camp for that, not only that little 4 months of, okay, kid, you got the ball, go, but 6 years of really keeping on top of stuff, making sure everything works all the time, fix it before it breaks. And I can remember after like 3 months when we were getting ready to start rehearsals, and John came into the rehearsal place or the one of the warehouses that we had mm-hmm. with a book about 7 inches thick, and he had notes from like everything he'd ever heard, every speaker, every kind of amp he ever used.
Oh wow.
And just on top of it, and this is the point where we're into selecting speakers for each guy in the band and how they were going to fit in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on top of it.
You got to get him to publish that. That'd be a great book.
And as he laid it out, I became aware of how X, Y, and Z fits into the whole presentation. It was great, man. I love that guy.
So he basically had, when you were working with him, he had two main systems.
Right. One would go to Australia, and we were touring in America with the other one, and then...
Now, is Australia 220 volts?
Yeah, but when we toured there and Europe, we did Europe every summer.
So what did you use to compensate?
The sound company would bring...
converters?
Our own power.
Oh,
so
okay.
We'd go from 220, and we'd have 110 on stage. So you'd voice a lot of problems that way. It was very consistent.
Well, it's interesting because I know some people that used, like, for example, the 220 Marshalls sound different than the 110.
They do.
And
they
the same do. Thing with the Fenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's, you know, there's advantages. It's kind of like, you know, it's probably those subtle differences, like different brands of strings and stuff like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things are going to sound a certain way because of X, Y, and Z. So,
yeah. No, I
sometimes you luck out and sometimes it blows up. Of course, you got to know what you got before you plug it in.
Oh, yeah. So. No, I've heard from friends of mine, even just playing around here in 110 land. One friend of mine, bass player, she was playing and they browned out on her and just killed her amp.
Yeah.
You gotta watch. I mean, it's little stuff like that.
Protection and circuit breakers and, you know, all down the chain. And
I know some groups actually had their own generators.
Right.
So they were off the grid.
Yeah, that's
so.
Right.
Now, we're almost out of time, but what's going on? Before I want to get all the information, how people can get a hold of you. But one question, and then I want to ask what you're up to, what's coming up now,
sure.
Is in looking at the guitars that you've modded or adjusted or whatever, how do you feel about the new guitars compared to the old guitars? Do you think that, in general, guitars are made better, or are they worse, or, you know, how do you feel?
You know, there are design things that are happening that are pretty great. You know, things seem to be moving forward. It's hard to A/B a new Strat with like a 58.
Okay.
Because first of all, you can use the same wood, but two different pieces of wood, whether they're from 58 or from 58 and 2016, they're going to sound different.
Right. But the pickups, for
the finishes make thickness and thinness of finishes and nitro versus polyester and all that. That, you know, you get choked or you're opened up, you know. But there's a lot of amazing people doing a lot of amazing pickups and electronics these days. And we have a whole giant knowledge base. You know, we know that's good quality pots and the right wire, the right gauge wire, and all that stuff in your guitar puts it over the top. You know, or doesn't choke or taper.
Yeah,
the expensive pickups that you've put in, or the 58s that you finally got. You know what I mean? And there's so many guys that are doing lots of their versions and some really good recreations of the golden age of pickups or a particular era and sound, you know. So I think we're in a good spot.
One of the things I noticed with even the guitars from like the late 60s, 70s, even, you know, after the CBS guitars where people didn't like them as much, is that the thing, especially like with Fenders, is they were fixable. You could get them to where you wanted to. Do you find that pretty much you can do that now? I mean, I know, yes, the pickup technology is down to a science.
Yeah.
But in terms of the guitars, in terms of playability and stuff, in general, most guitars are fixable, in your opinion? You can get them to where you want them?
You can. There are things you can do for the feel of the neck. Like, you can burnish the finish a little bit and make it feel less sticky and more like an old friend on your hand side, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can match the size and the mass of frets. So you can get that feel on the fingerboard.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, match the wood of the fingerboard. And you can. There's a lot you can do. You know, the key I think is to for me is optimal string height and pickup adjustments and, you know, neck relief, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had too rough of a problem with my inability to make almost any guitar I've worked with in the last 20 years play better.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider myself lucky that way.
Yeah.
You know, consider we got anywhere from 3 to 6 different pieces of wood.
Right.
And 24 frets and all, you know, different pieces of metal and all that. It's amazing that thing you go to the store and buy, that guitar, actually works, you know. There's a lot of technology and design and expertise that go into making all of it work together, you know.
Well, I had
kind of like America.
Yeah. But I mean, like, for example, I had on a couple weeks ago John Wicks, and he brought in this Strat that was made in Mexico, and that thing played great. And he said, you know, it wasn't the most expensive one, but it had the sound, and it was well made, and it played like a dream.
Yeah, Fender has a, you know, they've got a factory in Mexico. As you can imagine, those are coveted jobs. People are working really hard to maintain. And
they have a custom shop over there, too.
They do. And I have a couple of what they call Mexican relics that are sprayed nitro. They're like worn-in, road-worn, to simulate 30 years of playing with your old friend, you know, in clubs and all that. And those two guitars, that the Tele and the Strat, they sound you know, at 10% of the price of a 58 or a 62.
Yeah, for guitarists and also working guitarists who can't afford $20,000 for a 50s.
Yeah,
you know, it's there are good guitars out there, and the new ones. It's good to know that there's some
there are
great
and Fender. You know, Fender's got a whole history. A gigantic catalog of guitars that they're constantly reissuing and making available at different price points. And the most important thing, I think, when you go to shop for a guitar is you either plug it in or it's an acoustic, you strum it, and you'll know right away if it's right or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, let's give the information of how people can get a hold of you.
Certainly.
And what you do, besides setting up guitars, obviously, you do repairs, and you do amp repairs, too, right, in mods?
I do. I'm actually, I'll do amp repairs on the fly when I'm on the road. Neil. that number 3 tube's going bad. You better look at its dig. I happen to work with a couple of genius amp and studio effect guys. Robert Schoenrad and Roy, your last name escapes me, sorry, over at Valley Sound on 5527 Cahuenga in North Hollywood. These guys are just, they're geniuses. They're gigantic amp and effect repair guys. I love working with these guys. They're really smart and really nice. And I'm lucky that they called me in about 4 months ago to be the guitar tech down there at Valley Sound. I also have a little home shop where I do work also for clients. But you can reach me, 213-924-4545. That place, I'm in North Hollywood in both locations, about a mile apart.
Mm-hmm.
My home shop is on Lancashire Boulevard. I do that by appointment. And the Valley Sound location is open 10:30 to 6:30 Monday through Friday, and Saturdays by appointment.
And then you can also get a hold of Stig at stig@valleysoundla.com.
That's correct.
Okay, so, and then real quick, we're out of time. I told you we'd go by fast.
Sure.
But what's coming up? Anything interesting that you're doing?
Well,
that you can talk about.
Every single guitar that comes through is really interesting. I love it. You know, people, I've meeting so many more players and so many different levels of guys coming in with stuff. It was a pretty amazing month and a half ago, Trevor Rabin came in, and he's a client of Stretch's, Robert Schoenrad. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about possible future work together. That may or may not happen. I've sown the seed.
I hope so, because I'd love to talk about his guitars. He's got some amazing guitars. Well, listen, thank you so much. And I want to thank, shout out to Monique Caravella, who introduced me to you.
Yeah, baby.
And anyway, 213-924-4545, stig@valleysoundla.com. I'm looking, I'll post some pictures of this guild that he brought in. But he does know his stuff, and it's pretty amazing.
This is the world premiere of the Guild Starfire Modifications with Mastery Bridge.
The Mastery Bridge. Anyway, thank you again. I really appreciate you coming down, and we got to have you back.
I want to come back with Curtis Lauer and Stan Lamendola and all kinds of cats.
Okay, we will do that. And then check out his Facebook page, Mark Stig Donnie. And you'll see some of the guitars that he's talking about. Everybody, have a great night.